Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Stack Trace. It's the podcast that is about life and technology from two developers' perspectives, with me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Mr. Rambo?
I'm doing great, John. How are you?
I am doing great as well, and I am happy that we are keeping up at least for 1 month now with our monthly schedule that we set out on the first episode after our big comeback.
See, we are keeping to our promises here.
Exactly. And yeah, it feels really good to be back in general with Stack Trace. It's been great to see the feedback of our first episode since the comeback there. So many people have reached out and been happy that the show has been returning. So thank you a lot for all those messages. Yep. And yeah, we're going to keep going. This monthly thing, I think, is going to work really well for our schedules. So I think it's going to be a great thing for everyone involved.
Yeah, definitely. So what do you have for us today? Let's start with you since last time I went first.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So just to recap, with our new format here now, we are doing like two topics per episode. So I pick one topic and you, Rambo, you pick one topic. And yeah, let's go with mine first this time. So my topic is actually going to be Android.
Ooh.
And that might be a bit surprising to a lot of listeners. Like on the last episode, I was talking about using Rust and Windows, and now I'm talking about Android. Like what's going on with me? What has happened in the last few years, right?
Who are you and what did you do to John?
Exactly. So, you know, I mentioned it on the last episode that even though I am definitely still focused on Swift and on Apple's platforms, you know, mostly doing iOS development as part of my freelance work and also as part of my, you know, own work and so on, and doing workshops and all these things around iOS and Swift, I also do some Mac development from time to time. But I like to branch out and I like to try different things. And recently, like I mentioned last episode, I've been doing quite a lot of Rust development. I've been doing some Windows development. And part of that also, that kind of curiosity to kind of try new platforms and to kind of branch out, I have been very interested in Android for quite a while. And I think, you know, a lot of iOS developers or like Apple users in general, you know, we might have this view of Android that is kind of like a, how would I phrase it? Like not our platform of choice. let's just call it that, right?
Yeah.
That it's, you know, iOS is a much better platform. We like it. We prefer it, you know, from the user experience to the security, to the stability, to the devices and so on. But, you know, quite a lot of things are happening. And I think for me personally, like I really like to keep an open mind when it comes to platforms. And even though I am mostly still working in the Apple ecosystem, I've been looking to try Android for a while just to kind of see what it's like and just to kind of judge it for myself, right? So that it's not just like, oh, this is what I've heard that Android is like, or this is what I've seen on screenshots or something, or when people make fun of it in the Apple community or something, but actually like try to use it myself. So before I get into my actual experiences and what I've been doing on Android, what are your thoughts about this, Rambo?
So actually, I have an Android device here and I've had one for quite a while because I thought it would be useful to have one around just to try things out on Android.
Yeah.
And even like if I make some website or something to try it out on Android and try out Android apps and even like Apple's services and apps on Android because they have Apple Music and lots of other things on Android, the AirTag app thing they made for Android. I actually think that was my initial, like, what made me want to have an Android device was when they released this AirTag app for Android where you can search for AirTags using your Android phone. And so, but I got like a fairly inexpensive Xiaomi device, so it's not like particularly good necessarily. Like it's definitely underpowered for the system, but it runs acceptably, I will say. Like it's a bit slow to my liking because I'm used to having always the like the latest iPhone, which is very fast, but it's perfectly fine. And I also had a really interesting experience with a Google Pixel because I think it was like 2 or 3 Christmas ago, I gave my dad a Google Pixel for Christmas because he uses Android and he's old. So change is not easy for him, even though he has an iPad and loves it, and like I tried to convince him, but it's going to be just like your iPad, but he was not having it. So I went looking for like what's a really good Android device, and Google Pixel was the one at the time. I don't remember exactly which version. I think it was like maybe the Pixel 4. And I got him one. It's not even officially sold in Brazil, so I had to do some work to get it imported. But I really wanted it to be that device because I knew it was the best one at the time. And also because I really wanted to try it out and see how it is. And he's using that device to this day, and it is a really good device. Like, the cameras are great, the display is really good, it runs super well. So, like, it's not my platform of choice, but it's really good, especially if you get, like, a really good device.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the beauty of the Android ecosystem in general, is that there are so many devices. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, in a way, like Linux, where because it's more open... you can get it on so many different form factors and so many different, you know, kinds of devices that make different trade-offs and different choices around things like, you know, camera, screen, form factor in general, and so on. Yeah. In fact, the Android device that I have bought is actually a gaming device, big surprise, which is called the AYN Thor. And I really love this device. It's a dual screen handheld that runs Android. So it has two OLED screens. So you can use it, you know, both for kind of multitasking, where you can play a game on the top screen and you can have like something like a guide or just notes if you're playing a puzzle game or something on the bottom screen, which is really cool. You can also use it for emulation, like emulating like Nintendo DS or 3DS, for example, with the both screens. And I've just been really, really enjoying like setting it up, tweaking it, playing around with it, playing a lot of games on it. And it's been really incredible. And the reason kind of why I wanted to bring up this topic, Android, was because, like I mentioned, I've been curious about it, but I hadn't really tried Android that much. I've always been like, you know, playing around with someone else's Android phone, you know, been curious. And you mentioned, you know, when you got your dad the Pixel, you know, you've been trying it out. And, you know, it's been cool to see like also Android evolve, just like how iOS evolves, right? And how they kind of converge on certain things, like how they display notifications and the swipe gestures for multitasking and so on, which are almost identical between the platforms, and how they also make very different decisions in other parts. But this is the first time that I'm owning a device myself that runs Android. And that's why I wanted to bring it up, because I have some kind of first impressions to share, kind of as a longtime Apple iOS focused user, like what my experience has been like now actually using an Android device that I own myself.
And it's actually your first time owning an Android device that you know of. Because who knows, like there are so many appliances these days that run Android.
That's true.
So
maybe my fridge is running Android in secret.
It could be, definitely. So how is the experience? I'm looking at pictures of this device and it looks really cool.
Yeah, so from a hardware perspective, it's really incredible. Like the OLED screens are so good. Like it really makes like games really pop on those screens. Like I play games primarily at home on my OLED TV, and playing now handheld on these OLED screens is like very much the same experience in terms of like, you know, contrast and actual picture quality. So that's been incredible to have that in that form factor. And also, like, I was really looking for a clamshell device because I do quite a lot of traveling. And also, like, when I, you know, drive my son to different appointments or something like that and I have to wait, then it's great to have a device that I can just keep in my pocket and kind of just, you know, take it out, open it up, and just start playing a game for like 15, 20 minutes while I'm just waiting for something.
Yep.
So hardware-wise, it's like really, really good. And the software side was kind of what I was mostly curious about because, you know, I think in general, as iOS developers, sometimes we have this view that, you know, iOS apps, they perhaps tend to be a little bit more polished, or they tend to have like smoother animations, smoother scrolling, better performance, perhaps be designed in a way that aligns more with our tastes. I don't want to say like better design, because design is subjective, right?
Yeah.
But design that we like in the Apple world, right? Like there's a certain uniformity usually to Apple apps, or not just apps developed by Apple, but apps on Apple's platforms, right?
Yeah.
And that's what I was curious about going into Android, where it's more like a Wild West in terms of design and user experience and so on. But I will say, like, in general, the experience has been very positive. I think in terms of performance, scrolling, gestures and things, it feels very similar to iOS. The things I've noticed mostly are like that perhaps some parts of the OS are a little bit like less polished in a way where when you bring up the keyboard, for example, like the animation isn't always as smooth that when the keyboard pops up or things like that, like these kinds of system interactions. But on the other side, I will also say that on the Apple side, that has not also been perfect in the last couple of years, right? We've seen quite a lot of regressions when it comes to kind of system animations and sometimes things feeling a little bit off, even on the Apple side. So, you know, the Apple side isn't perfect, but that's just some stuff that I've been noticing that, you know, the smoothness isn't always there, at least not in my experience on Android.
And we have to blame garbage collection for that. Right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, much better with automatic reference counting, right? At yeah. least then you know when your memory is going to be cleaned up. But I will say, like, the thing that's been kind of striking to me is that as I've been playing around with mostly kind of games-focused apps and different launchers and different projects to, you know, I've been playing, for example, the old game Heroes of Might and Magic 3, where there's this Android app where you can take your version of the game from PC, like the files, and you can bring it into the Android app and it will just kind of run an Android port of it for you, which is incredible, right?
Yeah.
Which when you launch that app, you can tell that, okay, this isn't like standard Android UI here. This is looking more like some kind of cross-platform, perhaps UI library, or, you know, the UI here wasn't the main focus during development. And there is something I feel like is a little bit liberating also, like looking at it this way, like, you know, sometimes on Apple's platforms, I feel like we can perhaps get a little bit too focused around design and how something looks when, you know, getting something that works really, really well and that is, you know, doing the job is perhaps the most important. And especially when it comes to these kind of open source, kind of community driven projects, like, of course, it's nice if something has like, you know, really cool design and looks amazing. But if you can get what you want to get done, whether it's playing a game or achieving a task, then perhaps that should take priority sometimes. So it's just like interesting looking at these two communities, the iOS community and the Android community, and you can kind of see that overall the developer community has like slightly different priorities in general.
Yeah, I definitely noticed that, and you can see that, I guess, as a whole in between like Apple and Linux development or Apple and Windows development. I feel like we in the Apple community have a lot more developers who are not that they are necessarily designers, but they care a lot more about those aspects of development. And also, I think because Apple is so focused on that, typically they provide better tooling and APIs that make it easier to make a UI that looks decent. So basically, if you make an iOS app using the Xcode template and you use Swift UI without any customization, it will look decent. Like, maybe it won't look great, but decent enough and native enough that most people won't feel any particular way about it. So there's a lot involved with that. And again, it doesn't mean that one is better than the other. It's just different focuses.
Yeah, exactly. And I also feel like Swift UI specifically represents an interesting like part of this idea where, in general, I think the developer consensus around Swift UI is that if you're using it to build UIs that look the way Apple thinks that UI should look, then it's great, right? Yeah. Like, Swift UI is smooth. You can write apps usually very quickly with it or much faster than with UIKit. And you get a lot of things for free, like interactions and, behaviors that you don't have to specifically write yourself. But at the same time, like, as soon as you want to like really customize something and build something that has your own really like look and feel fundamentally, that can be quite difficult to achieve with Swift UI.
Yeah.
And that's like where you get this kind of conflict between convenience and customizability. And again, this is something that I feel like, you know, it depends on what the priorities are of the platform holder and of the developer community. where I can see a much bigger focus on kind of the customizability on Android, not only like from the platform holder, but also like in the developer community and all the way through the user, where when you open up an Android app, sometimes they will have like a huge amount of customization options in their settings. Like I've been playing around with this game launcher called Cocoon, which is actually really, really well made and very polished, even though it's still in beta. But if you open up the settings there and you go to like animation settings, you can like tweak all the animations in the app, like how you want them to be, like in terms of speed and animation curve and so on. And you can tweak colors and all sorts of things. And it kind of also just shows how the developers think around their apps and think about user customizability, that it's not a design that is like set in stone, but it's like, here, we're giving you the flexibility, you know, all the way from the platform holder all the way up to the user, which again just shows kind of different priorities and a different way of thinking compared to what we're used to on the iOS side.
And let's be honest, lots of us have the UI in our apps. It's just not shipped to users.
Yeah, exactly. We have that like developer menu, right? That is exactly. Like secret only for us.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's really been kind of my first impressions, is that it's a much more polished experience than I thought going into it. It works really, really well. Stability and so on seems to be great. Granted, I'm not using this device like as a, you know, daily driver or something. It's for gaming. But I've been very, very impressed with it, both from kind of a hardware perspective and on the Android software perspective. And it's been very interesting just to see that kind of difference in thinking, or like the difference in overall kind of design and how it works on the Android side compared to what I'm used to on the iOS side. So now I'm looking to like get more deeper into this also as a developer and trying out, you know, there's now Swift for Android as well, which I really want to try out. So yeah, it's an exciting new chapter here for me, being now not only a Mac user, iOS user, Windows user, but now also an Android user.
Yeah, I was about to ask if you looked into developing for the thing, but I guess that's going to be the cliffhanger.
That's going to be the cliffhanger. I have done a little bit of like just playing around with development work and so on, but not much yet. Like I don't have any real well-formed thoughts on it just yet. But again, this is where you can see that the setup is quite different from, you know, what you're used to on the iOS side, where, you know, you download Xcode, you get everything in there, and you have Swift UI, and you get started building an app. Where on Android, it's more like, you know, with Gradle and with Android Studio, and then if you want to like plug in different things, like again, more customizability and more open tooling, but also coming from, you know, just the outside perspective, you know, it's something new to learn and something new to kind of get used to.
And it's a lot more modular from what I remember. And Xcode has been going in that direction. Like these days, you don't have to download the whole simulator runtime for a platform you don't develop for. So like I typically just download the iOS simulator. So I don't have to have the tvOS one or whatever. And I remember with Android Studio, it's a lot like that. You download the SDKs for the things you actually want. So you don't have to download like 20 gigabytes of stuff if you're not developing for that particular platform or device.
Yeah, exactly. And modularity in general, you know, it can be a bit of a double-edged sword. But in the case of Xcode here, and getting things to become more modular, I think is a very, very good thing. And like having the SDKs be separate also makes a lot of sense as the platform grows and as the number of platforms grow as well, because not everyone is going to develop for VisionOS, for example, right? So yep. It wouldn't make sense to require every developer to always download those SDKs.
Right.
So speaking about modularity, I think now we can switch to your topic, Rambo, which will be a little bit more developer focused and where I think we will have like more strong opinions than on the previous topic here. So what do you got for us?
So I would like to talk about package managers. And of course, we're going to talk a lot about Swift Package Manager, or SPM for short. And what kind of prompted me to think about this topic again was the recent trend of a lot of issues around package managers, and more specifically security issues that happened, and not because there is a fundamental flaw with how a particular package manager is implemented, although that's debatable, and we'll get to that. But basically, like, someone has a popular package on like NPM or the Python package index, and somehow they get compromised, like an authentication token leaks somewhere, and someone uploads a malicious version of the package, which sometimes aims at compromising the installations of the actual product that uses the package. Although more commonly, what these malicious packages try to do is compromise the developer themselves. And the most recent and very dangerous hack that occurred was on NPM with the Axios package. And when I saw that, it rang a bell, the name Axios, because I remember seeing that in my package.json, because I do have some Node projects. And luckily, I didn't run NPM install during the time window that the malicious package was up. But it really scared me into thinking about what can I do to try to protect myself from this type of thing. And also why we haven't seen anything like that occur with Swift packages yet. And I think I know the reason why, but I would like to hear your initial thoughts first.
Yeah, sure. So package management is a complex topic, right? Because it's hard to do it in a way where you hit this kind of golden zone between not having all the packages be too small and complicated and ending up in this kind of dependency nightmare where you depend on one package and then all of a sudden you have 200 packages downloaded because of they depend on each other so much, which is definitely, I think, more of a case on the NPM side. I think on the Swift side, we are seeing more with Swift Package Manager, slightly like larger packages and less of a kind of standardization in the community between different packages, which I'm also seeing more kind of in the Rust space where you use Cargo, the Rust Package Manager, where there's more like, okay, we've all agreed that we're going to use this library for error handling, or we're going to use this library for file IO, or this for async, and so on. And the community kind of standardizes more around certain packages, which creates more kind of inter-package dependencies. So that's just been my kind of top-level observation, is that on the JavaScript side, on the NPM side, you tend to have like more granular packages that then gets composed, where on the Swift side, it tends to be more kind of slightly larger packages that are used kind of by themselves, even though, of course, they sometimes do have dependencies as well.
Yeah, like famously, there's like a, I don't know, isNumber package or something like that for NPM, where it's like, it's a function to check if something is a number, which is kind of odd that you need that. But
it's important to also remember like the context where on the Swift side, we have access to both the Swift standard library. And then if you're targeting Apple's platforms and even Linux also as well, Foundation, which just provides so much functionality kind of out of the box, which also minimizes the amount that of these kind of utility packages that need to exist.
Yep.
Where if you don't have like a Foundation or standard library in that sense, like you don't really have on the JavaScript side. Of course, there's like a JavaScript standard library instead of features. And there's like, you know, if you're targeting the browser, there's the browser APIs and so on. But there's not that same kind of equivalent of something like Foundation from Apple or the Swift standard library, which provides like a lot of that functionality kind of out of the box.
Right. And also another difference, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if I'm remembering correctly, NPM has like a centralized package index that's the source of truth for packages. Is that right?
I think so. I'm also not 100% sure about this, but I do think there's the NPM registry, right? But you can probably have third-party registries. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah.
That's also an interesting topic when it comes to package management, right? Because like, how do you discover packages? And there's now this Swift package index for Swift, right? Where you can search for packages, but that is not involved in the resolution of packages, right? That is just like a discovery mechanism. You're still like directly targeting Git repositories yourself, like in your package manifest. And this is another like interesting, like, you know, how different platforms solve this, where again, on the Rust side with Cargo, you are typically not specifying direct Git like URLs. You are just specifying package names and then the Cargo registry resolves that, similar to what happens on the node side.
Right. And according to ChatGPT, NPM is a centralized package index, so registry.npmjs.org.
Right.
But of course, you can have other registries and you can specify those. But we do have Swift package index, but it is not a source of truth, right? It is a place where you can discover packages and learn more about them. And they do a lot of really incredible work of building the packages and checking against different Swift versions to see like if they work with strict concurrency and stuff like that. So it's a really good resource. And but it's not the source of truth, which is the package's GitHub repo most of the time, or a local
directory. And that's also in contrast to CocoaPods, which mm-hmm. Most of us used to use before Swift Package Manager came into play, which works similarly to how NPM and Cargo works, in that you were specifying your pod names that would then be resolved by the pod registry or whatever it was called.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting differences in models, right? Like I think personally, the Swift model strikes a really nice balance, especially now with the Swift package index, which is an amazing project where using the Swift package index, you get the discovery part. You can search there and find packages. Like you say, they do a good job of showing you compatibility. They can show you the README and issues and so on, like metadata around each package. So you can easily like browse and discover, but then you as the developer are responsible for kind of targeting the package, like with the version and the URL yourself, which means that you are in control and also perhaps a little bit more aware of where the package comes from and, you know, where the source of truth is.
Right. And I mentioned that because I think at least in some of the instances where a compromise has occurred, it was on the registry side. So basically, let's say the developer has a token that allows them to publish stuff to the index, and that was the thing that got compromised. And if you are a developer and you have to publish your package to an index, what do you often do? You have that happen on CI, right? So you
right.
make like a GitHub action or something like that, which, by the way, I don't use GitHub Actions because I'm scared of them, because I would say like 80% of these types of compromises that I see recently have something to do with GitHub Actions, which of course it's not the fault of GitHub Actions itself, but it's like some misconfiguration somewhere. But if so many people are misconfiguring their GitHub Actions, I think something is wrong.
Could it be like the challenge in general of having CI be configured in the repository when it's an open source repository?
Yeah.
Because that's always tricky, right? When you need yep. to have some secrets, you need to have some specific config that you don't want to necessarily share with everyone, but you want everyone to be able to use it. And if it lives in your repo, then, you know, that's kind of tricky.
Yeah, I wanted to have some CI actions in my GitHub repo. I think it was for the WWDC app for macOS, but I couldn't quite figure out how to ensure that it would be impossible for someone to trigger a notarized build of the app, because the actions would trigger Xcode Cloud workflows. And one of those is to basically create a shipping version of the app that is notarized. And if someone somehow gets to create a compromised, notarized version of my app, that would be a problem.
Yeah, yeah, it's really, really tricky. Yeah, like, you know, sometimes I've seen people use like commands on pull requests for this, like when you put like a comment and you can put specific keywords and perhaps you can like have a list of users that are allowed to trigger that action or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really hard problem to solve. And of course, you can have a separate CI environment that is only for you, that you push to when you want to trigger a notarized build. Mm-hmm. But then you have that problem of kind of two sources of truth in a way. Or yeah, it's not an easy problem to solve.
Right. And to be clear, I did research how to configure that sort of thing. And I found guidance on that, and I found how to do it, but I wasn't confident. That's the problem, right? So
right.
if I'm not confident, like it's my first time doing this, what if I screw up somewhere, forget a semicolon or something, and yeah, so I decided against it. I do have it in the VirtualBuddy repo because I don't have an authorization workflow for that one. So it's just, it does a development build for pull requests just to check that everything is still building and testing okay. But so that's the side of the package registry that we talked about, which is one aspect. But there's also like with the Axios hack that happened recently, the way the compromise occurred when, so there was the compromise of the publisher of the package, and then how did it do its thing on your device when you as a developer pulled the package? And it was, I think, with a post-install script. So basically, Node packages, NPM packages, they have a feature where they can run scripts, I think like before or after installation, and maybe there are other hooks as well. And those run by default unsandboxed, and they just run with, I guess, the permissions of the user that ran NPM install. So the first thing I did after I learned about this Axios hack was to figure out if and how I could disable these scripts from running. And there is actually an NPM command where you can set a configuration to completely disable running any scripts automatically. And I did that, which should be off by default, I guess. Like it shouldn't allow arbitrary remote scripts to run. Of course, that doesn't solve the whole problem because like, if I do NPM install, okay, it's not going to run any compromised scripts at that time. But when I actually run the project that I made using that package, maybe inside of my own project, it injects some malware or something. But at least it reduces the risk to some extent. And I would advise listeners who use NPM packages to maybe disable the feature where you can just run arbitrary remote code from unknown packages. I think I feel slightly safer.
Well, that's good. I guess the reason they have that feature is to be able to build like external dependencies like C++ libraries or something that you might be linking to, right? Or like run build commands in general, like that are not JavaScript related specifically.
Yeah, I'm sure there are reasons to have those scripts that are non-malicious, but it just hasn't been implemented to the level of security that I would like for myself. And that's where I think Swift Package Manager shines in this case. And this is the good thing I'm going to say about Swift Package Manager before we start talking about the stuff we don't like about it. it has, you can have scripts and build commands and things like that in Swift packages. But if they run in a sandbox, and even then, they, from my experience, never run automatically. You have to manually approve. And I guess it depends on what the type of development that you do, but for the type of development that I do, I rarely see those prompts for like, oh, this package needs to run a build command or something. So it's not often enough that it bothers me. And every time that it happens, it does grab my attention. And I actually go and look like, wait, why is this package running a command or something? And I actually go and look at what it's trying to do with that command. And it's always something that needs to be done. Like, I don't know if the package needs to generate code for some reason, like I guess like the open API stuff has to run a build command to generate code. So I think that's a good balance between convenience and security. Like the first time you're going to build with a package that wants to run build commands, you have to approve that. And I'm not aware of packages being able to run like a script when they are installed in Swift Package Manager. I think it's only like build commands, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's build commands. And also when you're using macros, right? Like when you're integrating a macro into your project, I've also seen that prompt that like, do you want to trust this macro? Mm-hmm. Which also makes sense because macros are also kind of generating code under the hood, right?
Yep.
Like, yeah, that's fundamentally what they do.
Yeah, and also there's the aspect of the package.swift file itself, which could in theory contain malicious code, but that also runs within a constrained environment that's not allowed to do whatever it wants. So that also helps.
Yeah. Which it's interesting, right? Like this is again like one of those like trade-offs and compromises that we have to make, where we, you know, we have to decide, do we favor openness or do we favor security? And like that's yep. There's the scale, right? Like how far can you push in either direction? Where it would be really nice to have more customizability and more control over a package's build process sometimes, where, you know, like you mentioned, you might want to generate code, or you might want to like look at the configuration file somewhere, or you might need to even like build an external dependency or do something else that, or check if a certain library is installed on the user's machine or whatever. Like there are a lot of legitimate reasons in order to provide a better user experience, like developer experience, that you might want to do something custom in something like a build script or a package manifest file. So the fact that, you know, on the Apple platforms and with SwiftPM, we have less of that, we have less ability to do things like that, does sometimes limit kind of the convenience that we can provide with our developer tools. But at the same time, it also enhances the security. So it's kind of like that constant push and pull between convenience and security.
Yeah, exactly. So speaking about Swift Package Manager, what would be your number one complaint? It's time to talk to the complaints department.
All right. So I also want to preface this with that I really love SwiftPM. I think SwiftPM has been an incredible upgrade for the whole kind of tooling of Apple's platforms.
Oh, yeah.
And I would say that my number one complaint is actually that I just want to use it more. Like I would love to see SwiftPM. And I think, you know, if we go back to Stack Trace episode 100 or something, probably we were even talking about it then, that we want to write like apps with SwiftPM manifests as the actual project file.
Yep.
Because that's just something that I feel like I'm kind of surprised that it hasn't really happened yet. There was that secret SwiftPM commands that existed in the Playgrounds app on iPad, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where you could write like an app, because you can write apps now in the Swift Playground app on iPad, and that does generate some kind of SwiftPM app manifest. But I don't think that's something that is like, you know, you can just use it yourself from the command line and get going to write an app, unless I've completely missed something.
Yeah, you're right. So I don't know why it hasn't happened yet. Probably because I guess they made those things specifically for Swift Playgrounds on iPad, and they are not ready to make it API, basically. So it's not finalized. But if you make, and I'm pretty sure you can actually open one of those in Xcode on the Mac, and you can look at the package.swift. Maybe Xcode doesn't show it, but you can open it in an external editor and see it. And I remember it looking really nice. It was basically a Swift package declaration, and it had some special declarations that basically said, hey, this is an iOS app. And you could just have an iOS app built as a Swift package. And that's how Swift Playgrounds works to this day on iPad, when you create an app project and you can open those in Xcode and even ship them to the App Store, which is amazing. So they have the capability, but it's definitely not meant for third-party use just yet. And I'm really hoping we'll see news around that on DubDub this year or shortly after, because it would be really cool to be able to have your entire project be based around Swift packages. And I say that because my number one complaint about Swift Package Manager, which I also really like, to be clear, but my number one complaint is not about Swift Package Manager. It's about Xcode. So basically, the way it works inside Xcode when you're using Swift packages in an Xcode project, it's not great. It doesn't work very well. It has lots of bugs. Like I use quite a few private packages that are in private GitHub repos. And every now and then, out of the blue, Xcode decides that it doesn't trust the SSH key of the GitHub server for some reason, and I don't know why.
Mm.
And there's a little edit credentials link button in the error message that shows up. But when you click that button, nothing happens. And I found someone on the Swift forums saying that, oh, you have to double click it. I double click it, nothing happens. I actually went spelunking inside Xcode to try to figure out exactly why that happens, but I couldn't figure out why. And I don't know, there's sometimes I open a project, like let's say I was working on this project yesterday, I open it today, and it just all of a sudden decides it doesn't trust GitHub anymore, and my packages are all broken, and then I have to like reset packages, clean up build folder, restart my Mac, and
reinstall Mac OS.
Yeah, and at some point it works again, but I never know exactly what I've done that made it work again. So if you're at Apple and you're listening, please take a look at that. It would be great.
Yeah, this is, I think, in general, like one of the biggest themes when it comes to Apple's developer tooling in general is that it's sometimes really, really hard to know why something is going wrong. It's hard to know how to fix it. And the error messages can sometimes be very, very hard to parse. Or like you say, there are buttons that you click and nothing happens. Maybe something is happening under the hood, but you have no idea, right? Mm-hmm. It's very opaque in that way. And I think, like, fundamentally, the problem stems from that there are just so many interconnected systems under the hood working, right? Like, yeah, there's some process running Swift PM and running, like, a Swift language server and, you know, providing autocomplete and all those things, like, with SourceKit and all those things. And then you have, like, the IDE itself and the build system and its kind of UI layer and the Xcode project and all the things, like, all of these things interacting and trying to work together. And this is where it becomes really complex and it becomes very fragile, right? It's interesting how now, again, that I've been doing more Rust development, I think Rust, they've done a really, really good job with the tooling in general and also with the error messages. And when something goes wrong, you usually get like a really good error and you get like a link that you can click to go to a website where they will explain the error even better, right? Like provide like examples and more context and so on, which is really cool. Like it like really shows like a pretty big investment in like error reporting and the developer experience in that regard, which is a big part of the development experience is handling errors, right? Like yep, build failures, dependency failures and so on. And this is where I feel like still like Xcode is really lagging behind here other environments where it would be really great to see kind of a simplification of the whole build system and build process. And I know it's not easy to do because there's so much legacy and, you know, all these different platforms and you have Xcode with SPM and so on. But that's again why I would love to see something like, you know, let's go ahead and like deprecate Xcode projects or perhaps make them like that you can generate them with Swift Package Manager or something like you used to actually do. And then have Swift PM be the path forward or perhaps some other system, but to have this modern kind of system that we can use for building our packages, building our apps, managing the dependencies, managing the build system, and to have it be more transparent and easier to debug, I think that would be really, really cool. And it's definitely one of my, you know, top desires for as being an Apple developer.
Yeah, same. And I do think they have been working towards that. If you look at what's been happening under the hood in the past few years, Swift Package Manager has gotten better and better as time goes by. And again, like the issue I mentioned only occurs when I use Swift packages in an Xcode project. In that they never happen when I'm using a standalone Swift package, even if I'm using it in Xcode. So it's definitely the interconnected parts problem that you mentioned. And I know that they have like the new Swift build system or something like that that they have been working on. And I think that's what Xcode has been using for a while by default. And also last year with Xcode 26, by default, your Xcode project uses synchronized folders with the file system. So you no longer have to maintain these two sources of truth, like have folders, like groups inside your Xcode project and folders on the file system, and those are not necessarily the same. I actually recently did the work to convert AirBuddy into folders because it has lots of modules, so it took me quite a while. And I actually found a bunch of like files that were just sitting there that were like from AirBuddy 1 or something that were not in the Xcode project. So I completely forgot about them. So I deleted a bunch of old stuff and went through the process of converting everything from groups into folders, which is great because now when I like add a new file or delete a file, it doesn't change the Xcode proj file. So Git merges are a lot easier to do. Partial commits of, oh, I changed 6 files, but I only want to commit the changes in 3 of them, and one of them is new. Before, I would have to like look into the Xcode project and see if I had to commit the project as well or only part of the project file. So it was a big mess, and now it's a lot easier. And if you think about the sort of things you would have to do in order to allow for Swift packages to replace Xcode projects, that's one of the steps you would have to take.
Yeah, exactly. And this is, I think, a really big pain point for a lot of teams. And that's why you see the popularity of tools like Twoist, for example, where you can generate your Xcode project just from the file system, like treat the file system as a source of truth. You know, projects like that are great and definitely help a lot. Like, I'm always trying to use the file system just as a source of truth because, well, that's what you're interacting with all the time, right? When you're adding files, when you're staging your commits, when you're reviewing code, it's like you're not, I don't think a lot of developers go through when they get a pull request and review like the Xcode project file changes super carefully because it's hard to do, right?
Yep.
It's like it's a hard format to read as a human, especially if like the changes are big. But files, you can easily see, oh, this file was added, this was removed, this was renamed, this was, changed in some way. And I just think that that's really the way to go. And SwiftPM uses that as well, right? Like with SwiftPM, you don't have like a list of source files. You can actually do that if you want to, but by default, it just uses the file system as the source of truth. And I would just love for that to just be the norm always on Apple's platforms.
Yeah. And then there are other things that I can think of that they would have to do to allow that. Like, for example, I don't think at this point it's possible to build Metal code in Swift packages. You basically have to compile it at runtime using Metal APIs if you want that. I'm pretty sure you can't have like a .metal file and it will build a Metal lib in a Swift package because I tried to do that and it didn't work. And also, if you want to build for ARM64E, which is the enhanced security mode, you can build Swift packages for that, but it requires an Xcode project and it requires adding like a weird hidden flag manually to the workspace file or something that basically tells it to build Swift packages for ARM64E, which is kind of weird. But so they will have to do more stuff still, but I think it's all doable and it's not I think the difficult part is mostly done, which was the whole build system and the synchronized file system. I think with that stuff done, it's a lot of minor details that have to be fixed, such as compiling for Metal. And I guess also like, I don't know if like app intents metadata extraction works in Swift packages. I would have to try that out. Or also generating asset symbols. Not sure if that works. Also, another thing, this is not totally related to Swift packages, but I wish they would fix that if they did this for Swift packages, which is the generated asset symbols are not made public and you can't make them public. So, yeah.
Right.
Please fix that, Apple.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, that's the downside of having the tooling, like, have these, like, two worlds. You have the open source world with SwiftPM. You have the closed source world with Xcode, right? And those worlds very often collide. And Apple definitely, it seems like they are way more focused on the closed source aspect of their tool chains, like on their SDKs, on Xcode, and things like that, rather than on the open, which is Swift Package Manager. Like, I think, so far, I mean, Swift Package Manager has been out for like 10 years, right? Mm-hmm. And it seems like Apple in general has been kind of happy just like keeping it like a package manager for libraries, right? Specifically, not become like a, you know, orchestration tool for any kind of module or any kind of target. But I would like to see that, or at least I would like to see, like I talked about earlier, like a unification between the two. So you don't have like these, you know, oh, you can't do that with a Swift package. You can only do that in Xcode or vice versa, or like this module access level for assets and so on can only happen inside Xcode, not in your Swift package. You know, like there are so many of these caveats always, and that's where you get when you have these like two completely separate worlds. And it makes things a lot harder as a developer because you don't always know, like, oh, is this not working because I wrote the wrong code, or is it not working just because I am invoking the tool wrong, right? Like, or I should have clicked this button in Xcode instead of doing it on the command line. Like, yeah, it's, I think that's a really fundamental problem that needs to be solved.
Yeah, and I have a lot of hope about this because Apple uses Swift Package Manager themselves. When they open sourced their private cloud compute source code, it's lots of system frameworks and daemons that run on PCC hardware and also on iOS. And there are lots of Swift packages in there, which means Apple uses Swift packages. So they probably face a lot of the things we're talking about here. They probably have a lot of those issues themselves. And as we know, when Apple dog foods, they do better work typically. And if they're dog fooding Swift Package Manager, I think we can hope that those differences and those sources of truth will be unified at some point.
Yeah, exactly. Because like I mentioned in the beginning here of this topic, is that my number one complaint about Swift PM is that I just want to use it more.
Yep.
Like I would love for it to just be like the tool to orchestrate any project that is using Swift, right?
Yep.
Just like how when I'm writing Rust code, I'm using Cargo. That's what I'm using. That's like the tool I'm using for, you know, setting up my dependencies, setting up my builds, configuring, you know, my project, my workspace. Like it's all done through Cargo. And that just makes it so much easier to reason about and to debug and to understand and to just manage the project, right? When you have so many different ways to do similar things, that's when it gets really, really complicated. And again, like I understand for legacy reasons and, you know, Apple, they have like these very vastly different development environments where, you know, you can use Swift to write like a Linux server application that is running on the command line versus like a Vision OS app, right? They're quite different beasts, but it would be nice to be able to at least like partially be able to do everything you needed to do using Swift PM and have like Xcode configuration files and so on be just something you can plug into that system if needed.
Imagine your entire app's info.plist be declared in your Swift package.
That's right. I just want to write it in Swift, you know? I want to write my info.plist by hand in Swift.
Handcrafted info.plist.
Give me Swift UI, but for info.plist. Is that going to come at WWDC 2026? Let's find out soon, right?
Oh, I surely hope so.
That would be awesome. All right, but I think it's time to wrap up this episode of Stack Trace. So hope you enjoy listening to us talk about our impressions using Android, which was fun, and also Swift Package Manager. And like always, let us know what you thought about this episode. You can reach us on Blue Sky, you can reach us on Mastodon or via email. Links will be in the show notes. And let us know also if there are any specific topics you would like us to talk about on upcoming episodes. Of course, soon we will have WWDC, which will be cool. And we will probably have a lot of new things to talk about from kind of the Apple tools perspective. Hopefully new Swift Package Manager improvements. We will see. But that's it for this episode of Stack Trace. So all that remains is for you to say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.